Welcome to Podcasting Tech, a podcast for busy entrepreneurs who want professional sound and appearance for their content creation. I'm Matthew Passi, your host, and a 15-year veteran in the podcasting industry. In this show, we interview podcasters and content creators to learn about the technology they use to make their shows sound and look amazing. We also connect with the people who develop software solutions to highlight the latest and simply greatest tools out there to help you be successful. Head on over to podcastingtech.com, where you can subscribe to the show on YouTube or your favorite podcasting platform, and join us on this exciting journey to unlock the full potential of your podcast.
Hey there, welcome to Something in Media, a show that tells the story of successful people in the world of media and what it takes to make it to the very top. I'm Dave McGuire. In this episode, we welcome along Yare Igihon, an experienced broadcaster at the BBC with a hell of a lot more experience under his belt to boot. We had a really good chat, and it shows that behind all that success often comes a lot of grind.
But I remember I used to go and do a show at Radio 5 Live called Fighting Talk. And I remember one day finishing that show, and whoever I was on with, you know, one person was going off to their book signing, and another one was going off to, you know, to a gig, the latest gig on their comedy tour, and another one was going on, I think Rick Edwards was going off to kind of present a TV show. And I went into the toilet, put on my Apple t-shirt, and went across the road to the White City, you know, to the Westfield, and went and did an 8-hour shift.
Talking to Yare, it's obvious that music is his first love, and this passion has propelled him from day one in his career. Long before hitting the heady heights of presenting early breakfast on national radio, Yare cut his teeth as a music student in Yorkshire, before coming back to London and getting his hands dirty working for various music startups who were looking to make a profit in an ever-changing industry landscape. As we'll hear, Yare spotted an opportunity as someone who could bring his love for music to the masses, and with a lot of hard work, hustle and talent, he eventually became one of the main voices on the then brand new radio station, BBC One Extra. He took another opportunity setting up a radio production company before presenting the weekend breakfast shows on BBC Six Music. He then went on to become an invaluable member of another national institution, the BFI. Yare's journey has gone full circle. He's now back at the BBC, but this time his role encompasses his talent for inclusion. We'll hear more about that in a bit, but first let's start with an introduction.
So, my name is Yare Igihon, and officially these days I am at the BBC a creative diversity partner. And what for me that means is each day is that I work supporting the people who make scripted content, radio and music, where at the intersection of what they do, creating output, creating content, intersects with the whole agenda around D&I. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about authentic portrayal, we talk about the people who actually get to make programs, how programs get chosen, which types of stories get chosen to be told, all of that in that area, you know, I'm kind of working in there and then helping people understand. So the BBC's got a lot of commitments in that area. Predominantly this idea that we committed £100 million towards inclusive programming. So I work with people a lot on that. And this idea that, you know, 20% of all of our production crews across TV will be made up of people from the three key underrepresented groups. So we have three groups that are really underrepresented, and those people are like disabled people, people from ethnically diverse backgrounds, people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And so essentially I help across those areas, like scripted TV, radio, music, with the representation, particularly around those groups.
Great. So let's go back to your childhood. You grew up in London.
Yeah.
Is that
yes,
right?
North London. Yeah, so my mum, she was originally in the sort of health service, so she was a midwife for a long time and then a midwifery tutor, and then she left there and, like, she did a kind of a master's degree while she was midwifery tutor and transitioned into sort of education. And so when she retired, she was running a department at the kind of College of Northeast London. And then my dad trained in law and was a barrister for a little while, and then was kind of like a sort of a kind of independent entrepreneur he tried, well, at least he tried.
Well, what kind of stuff did he do?
He did, like, he used to, like, so he was really good at, like, writing contracts and really, like, detailed contracts. And so he tried to do these really elaborate sort of pan-national trade deals and things like that. And he was always working on something and never seemed to really ever come off. Do you see what I mean? He was a bit like that. But, you know, he'd written a couple of books in Nigeria and things like that. So, you know, he was kind of a bit of an academic in that regard as well.
Okay. And at school, did you have one of those careers in mind when you were growing up? Or was he just completely the other way?
Nah, you know what? Like, weirdly, like, I didn't have any idea what I wanted to do. Then in my early teens, I went through a period where I thought I wanted to be a journalist. And I did a lot of stuff around that and lots of kind of, like, experience stuff and little courses and all of those sorts of things. And then around about sort of 14, 15, I really got into music.
Why are you interested in journalism? Do you just thought it would be fun to do?
I don't know. I think an opportunity came up to kind of look at it a little bit. So I did that. And then, so I don't even know where that came from. I just remember doing it. I don't know how I can't even recall how I kind of got into it. I think just it's one of these things where I think that's one of the things that's kind of difficult today for younger people compared to, you know, 30 years or 40 years ago, whatever it was. It was like, because there were all these different youth service things. So people would just go, oh, do you fancy doing this? Do you fancy coming to this centre and doing some archery? Or do you want to go to the scout centre and play football or whatever? There were all these different things that you could maybe kind of tap into that weren't like, you know, you didn't have to have a load of money to be able to get involved, which I think is a little bit different today. So, you know, the opportunity came along. I did this journalism course. It seemed pretty cool. We did a bit of, you know, kind of got into it for a bit, and then I kind of discovered music. So that was like, my mum used to send us along to Cubs and Scouts. I think it was just really about really filling our sort of free time out, so we just weren't just hanging about, because that's like, you know, that's kind of what you realize is what happens, is that's how you get into trouble, is that, you know, you'll just got too much empty time, and then if you don't find productive things to do with it, you can end up doing things that aren't maybe necessarily productive, and you can't necessarily always tell when you're 14 or 15, you know what I mean, which is, oh right, yeah, and if I keep doing this is probably not going to be lead to anything particularly useful. So I think my mum kind of got it into her head that she should really kind of fill up our days as much as possible. So we did a lot of things like scouts and stuff like that. And that's how I kind of met a few people and got into playing music.
So with music, it was making music, or was it listening to music, or the whole thing?
Performing and playing music, and therefore, like, so you had, you know, you listened to a lot. And listening to music was always just a kind of a basic, normal, standard thing. Do you see what I mean? Everybody that I knew or everybody that I came into contact with had their own sort of music taste, for better or for worse.
What was yours?
So I was very much involved and very much taken with the beginning of hip-hop. I think the first gig that I ever went to see live was something like Maceo Parker and the Horny Horns at the Town and Country Club or something like that. Do you see what I mean? You know, so we were very much into that sort of, that was sort of retro. When we were kids, that was retro. Do you know what I mean? So that had all happened when we were very little kids, or just before we were born. And so we would then go out, and those were the sorts of gigs that we were going to and everything. And I kind of got sucked in with lots of other people who were really, you know, like, because, you know, you'd go to these things and you'd meet people and you'd be like, I'm going to go off and do this. And you think, so one of the things that happened is we started kind of playing music and stuff like that. A lot of the people who were good at music and were doing things on the manor, they were all going to this place called Islington Sixth Form Centre. And it's like, okay, right, well, this first chance I get to get out of my school, I'm going there. Do you see what I mean? Because that's like, that seemed amazing. Everybody was like playing music, and then when they weren't at school, they were going off and playing gigs, and like people were doing stuff with it, you know. And there's loads of people who went there who went on and became really successful musicians and everything. And I thought, yeah, I want a piece of that. Yeah. And so I went along, and I did all right, you know. I think ultimately, I mean, I went from sixth form like studying music, and I got on to a popular music studies degree and actually did really well on that degree. I got a first, but like,
so this is according to my notes anyway, you studied pop music at, was it Leeds University?
Well, yeah, so a place called Bretton Hall, which is a college of Leeds University. So it was a little, it was separate from, at that point it was very separate from Leeds, in that it was based on a campus just outside of Wakefield, right by the Yorkshire Sculpture Park. It was a very, it was very much its own separate thing.
So coming from North London, what was that like, going that outside was of Wakefield?
That was a real culture shock. It was really, really weird. I really struggled at first. First 6 months, maybe more, I probably came home every weekend. I did a lot of National Express journeys, do you know what I mean?
Which you do when you're a student.
I really found, at first I found it quite difficult because it was just, it was too much of a kind of a culture shock, and it took me a while to kind of settle down into that sort of student sort of life, because it wasn't really, it was very different to what student life at that point outside of London was very different to sort of being a student, like sixth form or whatever, up until that point. So it's not like, you know, when you're sort of 18, 19, finishing off your A-levels, it's not like you never went to a pub, but it wasn't the centre of the kind of culture. Once you go up, you know, you go to Wakefield and everything, everything's based around the student union or like pubs and things like that, and it took me a while to kind of get into that whole thing and adjust. You know what I mean? I wasn't necessarily a big drinker or anything, so it took me a minute to kind of find my sort of. It's not like I was having some sort of a nightmare. Do you see what I mean? I was at a university college in Wakefield. Do you know what I mean? So I maintain that one of the only reasons I did really well at university is because it was really difficult for me to miss classes, because I was the only black person on my course. And so literally, you know, the tutor would walk into the room and immediately be like, yo, where's Yari? And, you know, I'd right. be like, okay. Yeah, so there was a dude on my course who missed most of the first year, nobody noticed. But that wasn't an option for me, and I had to show up for every class because everybody immediately noticed when I wasn't there. If I was like 2 minutes late, people would be like asking where I was. So I knew I had to always show up, and I maintain that the only reason I got a first class honours degree is because literally I just showed up to every class.
With that, was there discomfort, I suppose, or was it just awkwardness? Or
I mean, the thing is, you kind of get used to it, because the further up you went educationally, the less other black people you saw at that point. Anyway, so it was like, by the time I got to like A-levels, I'd gotten used to the fact that, like, you know what I mean, we were thinning out a little bit and spreading out and going off and doing our own different things. So, you know, it was Yorkshire. I wasn't expecting to. Weirdly enough, that was one of the things that I found, that, like, that's the thing that you do. That's one of the mistakes that you make when you're in London in that era. You think, okay, yeah, black people live in London, right? And then, you know, and that's it, right? And then you don't necessarily realize, you know, I was a year or so into being at uni when I kind of discovered the sort of community that was kind of coalescing around, particularly around black music, in sort of like the north, like, you know, northwest, like Yorkshire, Huddersfield, you know, so places like Wakefield, Huddersfield, Leeds, Sheffield, that area of the country. Do you see what I mean? You know, I naively believed that, oh yeah, no, all the black people in the big, they're all in London, right? And I was coming up to be on my own. And actually, once you start to kind of live there for a bit and start to kind of reach out and do things, like I got very involved in setting up and running a funk night, because obviously funk, you know, we were into that sort of retro music and everything at the time. And so I got into setting up a night that would play that sort of music and a bit of hip hop and so on and things like that at the student union. And then, you know, that kind of led to kind of meeting people in and around that sort of Yorkshire area who were, you know, other black people, other people who were really into the music and everything. And then, you know, during that period, I, you know, kept playing in bands and stuff like that and going out and doing gigs and all that sort of stuff. So
yeah, I was going to ask, did you keep up the music stuff when you left London? And
that was the whole point. I went to do a popular music studies degree, so I was playing all that period of time, I used to play bass guitar and sing a bit and all that sort of stuff. So that's what I used to do. You know, I mean, I played bass in bands and stuff like that. And, you know, you know, at one point we had a band called, like, so, like, at our college, there were two, you know, there were two kind of bands that had kind of formed, and you know what I mean? So one band was called Bolo Bolo, right? And the other, our band was called the World Funk Organization. The World Funk, think about that. I mean, just think about the scale of that. There were like nine of us, and we were the World Funk Organization. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, so...
any of your music still available?
No, good Lord, no. I mean, like, you know, I think if I went and, like, I'm still, like, in touch with the drummer on and off from the band, and he recorded things. I reckon he could probably dig out a recording or two of the band. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
But, yeah, you know, now, if you were in a band and you were half decent, you'd probably stick some, you know, you'd probably get all yourself together, and, you know, part of your course would be sticking something on Spotify or something. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, this was pre-digital music and all that.
So at that point in your life, did you foresee a career in the music industry then? Was that the goal?
Yeah, I mean, like, so when I first went to uni, you know, I thought I was going to be Sting, innit? I sang a bit, I played the bass, you know, and that's what I was going to do. I was going to be like, you know, Sting was the kind of the poor facsimile, and I was going to be the real deal, do you know what I mean? You know? And, you know, and it turns out that whilst I was really, really enthusiastic, I wasn't actually that talented musically. I'm naturally musical, but one, I hadn't worked out how to focus enough in terms of getting in the hours of practice. So it's like with anything, like, you've got like a sort of a bit of natural ability. There are some people who've got like sort of, you know, almost supernatural ability, and they can do it with what seemingly very little sort of commitment. And then there are other people who've got decent ability but have that sort of thing where they're able to really, really focus and really kind of hone and nurture that. And I didn't work out how I could do that until much later. Yeah, so by which point I'd stop playing music and whatever. So I only ever got so good.
Obviously, you excelled at university. You passed with flying colours.
Yeah, but like a lot of that was to do with... Because the thing is, had it all been just, okay, how well can you play, then I don't think I'd get a first. But I had to write, you know, to come up with an interesting kind of dissertation, and you had to attend classes, and that all played into it. So like I said, you know what I mean, part of it was that I never missed any classes. Mm-hmm. Part of it was that at the end of the second year, one of the tutors, an amazing woman, I think she's passed away now, it's really sad, but a woman called Geraldine Connor Crawford. You know, she'd started at the uni not long before I got there, or like when I went up there, the popular music studies course was brand new, and she'd been brought in to be, you know, one of the tutors on that course. And, you know, there were maybe a handful of, you know, black people in the intake that year, and so we didn't meet straight away, but when we did meet you know what I mean? Because, like, people had been asking her whether I was her son, because they just put two and two together. And, like, you know what I mean? So this was this thing. So when I finally walked in the room and she finally met, she's like, you're supposed to be my son. Do you know what I mean? She was deeply offended. Anyway, at the end of the second year, she pulled me aside and said, you know you can get a first, right? And I was like, really? And it just lit a fire under me. And I spent that whole summer just really banging out the dissertation, which was a big chunk of the mark.
Can you remember what the title was?
Yeah, so mine, something to do, it was about British hip hop. So it was like Brit Hop or something. I didn't, you know, and essentially what I did is I did a load of, I remember, like, weirdly enough, like, I interviewed Rodney P from from London Posse, and weirdly enough, then years later, ended up on One Extra with him. Yeah. Or like a load, I think Black Twang I interviewed for that, MCD, MC Mello, a bunch of people, and then I essentially put together a sort of a map and an encyclopedia of British hip hop artists up until that point. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I mean? And kind of a genealogy, you know what I mean? I kind of worked
out. What year was this, if I can ask?
This would have been 90. 5, maybe.
Because I was just thinking that must, I mean, in terms of documenting the British yeah. hip hop scene and that yeah. kind of movement, that must have been quite early on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it was. It was. It was very early on. And that sort of, what's really frustrating, because I wish I still had it, because I did a load of, you know, it was obviously it was hip hop. So, you know, it was that whole idea of, not just the music end of it, so the hip hop was like, you know, the rapping, the DJing and the cutting and scratching, the break dancing, all that sorts of, the graffiti and all of those sorts of things. So, so I presented it like that. So it was a big format thing, you know, and I presented it as a, like, you know, the kind of a book. I presented it like a book, you know what I mean? And I've done loads of design stuff and everything.
And it's gone. Yeah, I've got
no idea. I mean, like, I think I made 2 copies of it, one of which I lost in one house move or whatever, and the other one that was supposed to go into the library.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah, surely the university has a copy, no?
I don't know.
So was media and radio in particular, was that on your mind at all at the end of university?
Well, not so much, then, a little bit. So media was always, let's think, so from sixth form, so I did business studies, I think I did media studies as well.
Okay.
And like, you know, so like it was always in that sort of effort, and then I was always like, you know, I was just into whatever was coming next, you know. I was always at that, so like I remember being at uni, being one of the first persons with like a mobile phone that you're afraid to make calls on, because every individual call like cost an absolute fortune, and you just have this thing, you know what I mean? You know, just wait for it to ring. You know what I mean? It was like a Sony thing, it's like that, and a massive antenna that came out the top of the center of it. It's like ridiculous.
Could you even text on it, or is it?
No,
just,
no, I don't think you text then. No,
it had probably, could only store 10 numbers or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You could, like, you know what I mean? And I have no idea why I got it. It was absolutely pointless. Do you know what I mean? But like, I think maybe I made a few calls on it. Anyway, right, the point is, I was always into that sort of stuff. So I think off the back of uni, a couple of things happened. Obviously, I went back and started to, like, immediately was just like retail, just getting on with stuff and just trying to work things out from that point of view.
And you went, sorry, you went back to London.
Oh, yeah. And then, like, one of the guys that I'd been in the band with, he gave me a shout and was like, okay, right, you know, I'm down in London as well, I'm working in this studio, and you should come along. And so, weirdly enough, it was this kind of weird kind of connection. So he'd come, someone else I was with uni, their older brother was involved with this guy, and he was setting up a studio. He used to run these kind of club nights. It's called Sunnyside Up, if I remember rightly. And what the thing about these clubs is that it was the club you would go to when the clubs had finished. So it'd be like, it would start like ridiculously early, like Sunday morning, really early.
Oh, wow.
Like, do you know what I mean? Like something like 8 or something in the morning. So when you'd been out all night and then you still weren't done, you'd go Sunnyside Up.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean? And then you'd be raving into from the morning into the afternoon. And so he used to then book DJs for that. And then the guy who set up a studio and started making records with some of those DJs. And me, the drummer, used to be in the World Funk Organization. You see what I mean? Sets you up for success. And this other guy, this girl we'd gone to uni with, her older brother, we went and we started working in the studio. And then, you know, and obviously it was a bunch of kind of rave, do you know what I mean? Raves, club promoters. It didn't last that long, but it was enough to kind of get me started. And from there, I went into sort of a club promotions job with a company called CD Pool that was still going.
Yeah, tell me about CD Pool. Was this the technology company?
Yeah, kind of. They were just a couple of really smart dudes who'd been record execs. Essentially, they'd worked at the labels, they'd kind of signed things or promoted things. They'd done different jobs in and around the record labels. And they essentially, they set up what was a record pool. Mm-hmm. Well, like on, you know, what was the kind of burgeoning and emerging technology of the compact disc. And what they did was, which was quite revolutionary, they would go utilize their contacts around the record industry. Like, and you've got to bear in mind that most of it was, like, the record industry at that point was all kind of crammed into West London.
Mm-hmm.
It's just weird, one of these weird things that happens in this country where, you know, industry's kind of cluster in certain places. I mean, I suppose it happens everywhere, but in in London, a lot of the media industry had clustered into like West London, mm-hmm. right? And so you were able to kind of literally walk around or jump on a bike and go around loads of record companies and visit people and everything. It was quite close. You know, so what they'd done is they essentially used all their contacts in record labels, and they would get those guys to give them promos of new records just yeah. before they came out. They'd compile them onto a CD, and then DJs from all over the country would subscribe to the CD, and then they would get posted them. So, you know, so the job that I had is that I would compile a few CDs for them each month, and I'd organise, I'd run around all the record companies, find all the different records, compile them into different genre groups, work that all out, work out a kind of a CD master and kind of compile that all on a DAT or whatever, send that to the mastering house, get back a load of CDs, stick those CDs into envelopes, label up the envelopes, frank the envelopes, send them out. Do you see what I mean? And, you know, and then eventually, you know, eventually, like a certain percentage of DJs wouldn't get their CD each month. And, you know what I mean? There was a, like, we suspected there were a load of, like, do you know what I mean, aspiring DJs who were working as postmen who worked out, oh, do you know what I mean? This package will be full of CDs. And so a few would just go missing.
Well, that's right, because, I mean, you couldn't, there's no access online. This is literally the only way exactly. you could get yeah. this new music.
Yeah, exactly. So you'd get your promos, and then you'd have them, and you know, these guys were like, you know, mobile disco DJs and people like that. Do you know what I mean? Really kind of everything from like sort of keen kind of hobbyist sort of DJs right up to people who were actually had quite a lot of gigs and were playing around a lot of places and everything.
And at this point, because you were back in London, were you at home again or did you move out into your own digs?
This is one of the things, you know what I mean? So like I had, but my parents, they went through a weird period where they didn't have a house, so I was just forced to move out. So I moved in with a girlfriend at the time for a while and everything, and when that sort of fizzled out, you know, my brother, I have a younger brother who's maybe like a year, 9 months younger than me, and he was sensible. He didn't bother with all this media nonsense.
Because you said that if it wasn't for your brother, you probably wouldn't have a career in
Yeah, absolutely.
So he supported you during this time?
Yeah, well, I mean, not intentionally, I don't think. I mean,
begrudgingly.
You know, yeah, like, you know, I mean, the thing is that, like, so what happened was, I'd been knocking around doing bits and pieces, like the studio thing that I'd done had finished off a while ago. I'd gone, and so I'd gone from CD Pool. From there, I went to an organisation called DarkerThanBlue.com, which was like a black music website and everything. And they'd gotten, you know, they were in that first kind of dot-com bubble. And when people got cold feet, I think their investment had come from, I think, Chrysalis or something. And Chrysalis was like, oh, mate, I'm not sure about this. And they pulled the money, so they shut down the company. And I'd just basically taken a mortgage with my brother. And then, like, the job disappeared. And then, like, so that's why I'm saying that I have a career. Because basically, in that weird period between that finishing and one extra starting, he essentially covered my end of the mortgage. Do you know what I mean? And, yeah, and, like, kept us afloat, you know, and kept us in our house and everything, and kept me in a position where I could just keep trying things out. You know, I wouldn't have had the time to pursue, particularly because the one extra audition process was a bit drawn out.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back. This is Something in Media. I'm Dave Maguire, and we're listening to the story of how Yare Iggy Hon became a national radio treasure and a champion of inclusion. Before the break, Yare talked about his time leading up to the BBC One Extra presenter gig. It was a bit of a leap going from redundancy and having a mortgage to pay to suddenly being a presenter on a brand new BBC national radio station. Now let's hear Yare talking about what it was like leading up to that point.
The first thing that kind of that's fundamental and kind of foundational to that was, right, so I'm at darkerthanblue.com, right? And, you know, there's this idea that we have to develop the brand in the real world and not just online. Okay, so then one of the things was idea that people liked was this idea that, you know, we'd take the brand onto radio. We'd do a darker than blue radio show that would present all of the culture that the website kind of presented, you know, music and things like that. And I was there, and like nominally my job was as the audio editor, so like, you know, all the sound of audio content of the website I was there for. So I said, right, I'll try and do this thing. So initially the whole process was of trying, you know, we initially tried to speak to loads of the DJs and everything and said, hey, well, do you want to come and present the Darker Than Blue radio show? And they were like, yeah, I'll give me X amount of money. I can't remember what the numbers were, but they were large enough numbers for people to be, nah, boy, for an experiment thing like that, nah, we're not really paying that sort of money.
Yeah.
And so what happened was that one of the people who was also working on the website and doing audio bits and pieces as well was Jason and Lucia Fiore.
Sorry, what was Jason's surname?
Jason Mitchell.
Mitchell, okay.
And so what Lucia, who is currently and went on from there to become Omar's manager. You know Omar?
Yeah, yeah.
So she's still Omar's manager to this day, you know. I saw Omar at a gig recently and they were getting ready and there's this little woman. I was right at the back at like the O2 arena. There's this little woman running around the stage putting out like set lists or whatever. And it was Luch. And I phoned her. I said, get off the stage, you can't sing. Yeah, and so she's still doing that and she's doing very well. And Omar is still gigging and doing all sorts of things. Like, he was supporting Angie Stone that night. Anyway, right. So it was Lucia's idea that Jason and I would present, would put the show together and present the show together. And that's how we started working together. So what we did is that we had a deal with what was, at the time was called the Student Broadcast Network.
Yeah.
And so what they would do is they had essentially networked together a bunch of university radio stations. And they would then take over all of those stations and link them together. So they'd have a block of content that would went across a number, like, you know, a big chunk of the UK unis. And so, you know, then you could reach like a bunch of students, and that's how that kind of worked. And so we did a show, like, you know, this sort of darkerthanblue.com show was basically part of that sort of chunk of compulsory programming that went out to all of these stations. So the stations, they would do their own programming certain hours of the week, and then they would kind of become part of the new Student Broadcast Network for another part of the, you know, part of the day or whatever.
And how did you feel about doing a radio show? Because I assume this is something you hadn't dabbled in before.
No.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah. I loved, you know, I loved, because I was really into the music. Just so I, you know, yeah. I'd done a degree in music. I considered myself a music aficionado and that sort of thing, and you know, how music kind of linked together and where it came from and genius and how it was made and all that sort of stuff. So that was my angle into it, and I was like, yeah, you see, if you put this and this together, you know, you can kind of tell this story or whatever. And then Jason's angle into it is that he was actually out and DJing and everything, and that, so that we were quite complementary to each other in that way.
Great. And then, so with One Extra, I assume, well, you tell me, did you hear about this station being set up? And
there were rumours, just saying. And so, like, you know, so there was talk, you know, there wasn't like a, this is before there was like an official announcement or anything.
Well, a bit of context, like radio stations playing, let's say, urban music,
yeah,
to generalise it, were, what was there at the time? You had
Choice FM.
Yeah.
Lots of different pirate stations.
Yeah, yeah. Primarily London-based,
yeah,
pirate stations, but it was quite sparse.
Yeah.
Like today, it's mainstream.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite the same back then, was it?
No, not at all.
So the idea that the BBC were going to start a...
Yeah, so they're essentially their version of a pirate radio station.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so we were... So what had happened is that we were doing this show, we'd started doing that, and that was going all right with Student Broadcast Network, and then Darker Than Blue closed down, and Student Broadcast Network decided they wanted to keep the show on. So then it became like Jason and Yari's show and whatever, and we would just keep doing it. And so we'd go there every week, I think. Like, so I went from having a job to like having 50 quid a week income. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, they still paid you then?
Yeah.
They
paid us to do it. And, you know,
well, 50 quid.
Yeah. And then what had happened was I was I was like, you know, I think we can kind of parlay this into a show on One Extra if we just keep trying. So we kept going along to do the show each week. We would finish the show, burn it onto a CD, put the CD into an envelope, send the envelope to... We discovered that there was a guy involved in the setup of One Extra called Ray Paul.
This is before LinkedIn, yeah. Right? So how did you find out about that?
Do you know what? I don't even know. Do you know what I mean? It was Jungle Drums. It was just like the word on the street. Do you know what I mean? Like Huggy Bear came in and said, yo, psst, have you heard? Do you know what I mean? It was that type of a thing. You know, there was rumours going around and everything. And like, you know, so we'd kind of heard that Ray was involved in it. We found some contact details for Ray at the BBC and everything.
And just every week you
would just send him. Bung him our CD from our show every single week, and we just kept doing it. And then one day they got back to us and said, yeah, come in and do an audition type of a thing. And we started auditioning. We did a couple of days of recordings, and then they stopped. And we was like, oh, shit, we've blown it. And I think what had happened, I mean, I don't know for sure, but what I think is they had someone else that they were thinking of for our slot, and that didn't work out. So then they, you know, I think there's someone else they liked maybe a bit more, but that didn't work out. And so they had us in reserve. They came back to us.
Did you ever find out from Ray?
I don't know. No, I've never had that conversation. But I've heard rumblings, do you know what I mean? I'm sure, like, they're like, you know, if we go up there now, we could probably find someone who might know. You know, so the whole point was they kind of we auditioned for a bit, then they stopped, and then they brought us back, and we did a bit more, and then one day they said, right, you're in, you know, you stop everything else, be here at 4 o'clock on whatever day it was, and that was it.
So early breakfast slot,
yeah,
One Extra,
yeah. So we started. We were doing 6 till 9. Now, at the same time on Radio One, breakfast was Chris Miles 6 till 9. But we were called Early Breakfast.
Right.
Which I always assumed was just rank racism. Do you know what I mean? You just assumed that, okay, like this is the station. This is our normal station. This is our station for black people. And black people won't be up. So we won't do breakfast until 9.
6 till 9, I'm sorry, is prime breakfast.
Exactly. That's what I always thought. But for years and years and years, they called us Early Breakfast. I think by the time we left, we were the breakfast show, I think. But,
So two things. What went through your mind when you got offered this? It must have been spectacular.
It was amazing. It was one of the best moments ever.
Your brother must have been relieved.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't really get it. He just, you know what I mean? It's like, because he all thought because we'd always sit around talking about the industry, and you know what I mean? He's like, you potential wankers, the industry. Do you know what I mean? He just thought it was all nuts. But he was always really supportive. Do you know what I mean? So even though I think he thought it was a bit of nonsense. And from his point of view, he was right. It was nonsense. If you look at his car and my car, he was right. It was nonsense. If you look at his house and my house, yeah, it was nonsense. Do you know what I mean? If you look at his bank balance and my bank balance, yeah, he was right. It was entire nonsense. He was right. Do you know what I mean? He worked for banks and people like that. Do you know what I mean? And made some actual money over a long, sustained period of time. Do you know what I mean? So a lot of media people, I think you go up and down, it's feast and famine or whatever. Yeah. But like, you know, then he never got to interview Alicia Keys. So do you see what I'm saying?
Well, that's it.
Yeah, it's kind of...
Yeah. Yeah. You kind of have to have a passion for it to work in media. You can't... Nobody really goes into media, I don't think, for the money.
Yeah, I think at some point you have to think about the money because it has to be sustainable, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's not where you start off generally, you know? You just have to work out ways of kind of making it sustainable by earning enough money, you know?
Yeah, there's a hard, fast, you know, you need a salary, but there's also a lot of currency, and I get to, you know...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You get to do some amazing things and go to some amazing places and meet some amazing people, all of that sort of stuff, right? None of which is of any value when you show up at the bank needing a mortgage or wanting to pay your credit card bill or whatever. Do you see what I mean? It's like, oh, can you let me off my credit card bill? I just interviewed Samuel L. Jackson. It just isn't, you know, it doesn't have any kind of currency in that regard. But it does, you know, you know, there is a sort of a kind of a satisfaction to doing it and kind of getting to that sort of thing. So it was really amazing to kind of get the gig at One Extra, and it was a great relief as well. You know what I mean? Because they actually, you know, they paid us every couple of weeks.
Not just 50 quid. It was.
Yeah, you know, like, yeah, I mean, it wasn't like, it wasn't Moyle's money. Do you know what I mean? But it was, you know, it was enough. It was enough to live on, to have a mortgage, to run a car, all that sort of stuff. It was great.
Yeah. And so what year was that?
2002.
So you did, let's call it Breakfast Show, from 2002 to 2007.
Yeah,
that's quite a long run for a breakfast show as well.
I didn't feel like it at the time. We certainly weren't ready to leave at the time. Broke my heart to leave. Absolutely.
You were enjoying it. You kind of, did you find that you slotted into that that environment pretty easily?
I mean, the getting up was hard. Yeah. Getting up every day was hard, and I was. I don't remember my being like late loads, but like people who were around at the time, you know, look back and go, you know, you were always late all the time. And I was like, do you know what I mean? I'm not anymore. Weirdly enough, I think it kind of cured me of that whole thing of just being.
But I mean, you know, Breakfast Show, pretty much every Breakfast Show presenter I'm aware of was always late too.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. It's a very tough thing, because when we started, they used to make us come in at 4. Even though the show was at 6, so at first they didn't know us that well, and they didn't know that we could be, you know what I mean. After a while, they realised if I said 5, we'd be there close, and we'd be enough at 5, and we'd be in on time. Do you see what I mean? I think they thought if they cut you any slack, we're like, you know, if we tell you 4 and you're an hour late, you'll still be in at 5. Do you know what I mean? And so there'll still be time to get in. Do you know what I'm saying? But that's what I think it was.
And during that point, did you find your profile rising? A little bit. Were you doing extra bits outside of the BBC?
Yeah, I was, but it wasn't like that. I think is possibly one of the things that I didn't necessarily capitalize on in the way that I should have done. You know, so I did loads of things. Like I went and I taught BTEC at, like, you know what I mean, at the Citizen College, and I did other bits and pieces. But really, what I should have realized is, what am I in here, and what are the ways to kind of leverage this? Do you see what I mean? Which I didn't really do enough, you know, and I didn't have a plan, enough of a plan. It's like, okay, you don't, you know, so that's the thing. I think that's not like a regret, but if I look back on it, and or if I was looking at someone was kind of going, I just got the Breakfast Show at One Extra, right, what should I do? I would be like, yeah, you've got to have a game plan, because it doesn't last forever, and you've got to work out. It's very difficult to do that, to be on a national radio show every morning and have all this sort of thing, and like have, you know, this procession of, you know, famous people coming and sitting down with you and talking every morning, you know, every other morning or whatever, and then to not be doing that anymore is really tough, to go from there to that, you know. So the thing is that you've got to work out, you think, okay, well, what am I doing? You know, this is a really good platform, this is a really good opportunity, what am I doing to actually kind of capitalize on this?
Hindsight's a wonderful thing.
It is.
But also, I think you could be excused for two reasons. One, you were still quite young at that point, and two, nobody really knew what One Extra was going to be.
No, and you had no idea what it was going to kind of become, and you start, and it wasn't, in those early days, it wasn't the thing that it is now, you know, but it obviously had an impact, and, you know, it changed things a lot, you know, but you didn't necessarily know what that was going to be, and you know it's very difficult from inside it, you know what I mean, with a bit of hindsight. And you know last summer was the 20th anniversary of One Extra, you can kind of go, oh yeah, flip me now, you know.
And but, and now it's, as I mentioned, it is part of the mainstream, and you know Target has a TV show, you know, and that kind of thing, which you wouldn't have foreseen back in the early 2000s.
Totally, and I totally want to see more of that sort of stuff, you know. Like Target's involved in a drama series that's going to be coming eventually. Yeah,
is he?
Yeah. That's based on something. It's called, a thing called Grime Kids. He's involved in as well.
Is he acting?
I don't think he's acting. I think he's originated the story. The thing is, so that's one thing which I think is like amazing. And I want to see more of that sort of stuff, where, like, you know, that culture and those, that talent, the people that are involved in that network going off and doing other things and working in other places and kind of spreading that sort of the influence of it around more. And I think TV is a great place for that.
Yeah, well, the BBC it's kind of got everything covered in that sense. So it's
I think we could do more as an organisation. I think we could do more of that kind of cross-pollination. There's a certain things that, because there's this kind of weird equivalency that's made between something like the BBC and Netflix, for instance. But if we lean into it and we take advantage of who we are and what we are as the BBC, there are things that we can do that no one else anywhere can do. And one of the things is, you know, is linking up and using things like One Extra to kind of drive new and interesting TV and all the sorts of things. One of the things I dream of making happen, do you know what I mean? This is okay. But DJ Ace, you know Ace?
Yeah.
I'm a massive fan of Ace's, and he's a really, really good guy. And I have this dream of one day having him presenting on Homes Under the Hammer.
So what happened in 2007 then? Am I right in thinking you stuck around One Extra for an extra couple of years, 2009? So what was going on there? Did you...
I'm interested. So basically when we left One Extra, one of the exec producers pointed out that with the changes that were happening at that point in time, that we could potentially start a production company and pitch, because obviously we had 5 years of working at One Extra. We understood the culture of the organization and the music, and it was all ingrained in us at that point. So obviously we had as good an opportunity of being able to pitch to produce a show at One Extra as an outside company who had nothing to do with it, even if they were a really established company.
Yeah.
So we set up a company, Jason and I, and we made the overnight mix shows at One Extra. So 20 hours of content a week, 5 nights a week, 4 hour mix show with one of the DJs. Twin B was one of the DJs, and we had a different genre each night.
Twin B, lovely fella. Yeah. I went through a stint producing one of those, for cover. It was a tough show to produce because it was, was it 1 till 4?
Yeah, that's right. It's 4 hours. Yeah. So it was either 12 till 4 or 1 till 5 or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. How was it for you going from in front of the microphone to suddenly being, I don't know, I don't want to call it a businessman, but do you know what I mean?
It was different because Jason definitely took the lead in terms of working with the DJs and going, so we would pre-record all those shows. Do you see what I mean? So that was fine. So from an hours point of view, it suddenly became much more office hours.
Mm.
I think Jason took the lead on the creative bit of working with the DJs and everything. And I had to take the lead on all of the sort of business admin things and getting getting the taxes done and the accounts done and the PAYE and all of that sort of stuff. And, it's not Jason's fault or anything, but one day I'm on the phone with Orange or something trying to fix a problem with his BlackBerry. I thought, you know what? Sod this for luck. Do you know what I mean? This is not what I got into all of this for. And I was lucky during that period because what had happened was I tried to pitch Radio 2 for a Six Music show, for our company to produce a Six Music show, and ultimately they were like, oh, we don't think your company's experienced enough to produce a show for us. I was like, oh. But we liked you, come along and present the show. So that's how I ended up doing Six Music.
Oh, I see. So with Jason then, I've heard you say it was a bit like a marriage and you split up before you had to break up. So was that the kind of transition?
Well, it was more what it was? It was it wasn't the transition, because the thing is, obviously we'd kind of started working together to do the shows, and then the shows weren't there anymore. Do you see what I mean? And we had the production company, and after a couple of years, we didn't have the production company. Do you see what I mean? Because we didn't get renewed, One Extra didn't renew it. Do you know what I mean?
You had to learn some hard business lessons, you made me hire the wrong people, perhaps.
Yeah, the first time I ever hired someone was actually a complete and total disaster. I don't think the woman I hired, I don't think she ever completed a full week of work. I showed up Monday through Friday every single day, one whole week, the whole time she worked for us. Do you know what I mean? It was really, really bad. Yeah, we made a few mistakes with hiring and everything. And I learned a load about it, do you know what I mean? By the end, when we'd gotten it down, I wrote my own, numeracy and literacy tests, and then said, look, if you want this job, you have to complete this.
Interesting.
Do you see what I mean? So that I'd, literally, because we ended up, there was a point where we had someone who literally couldn't read and write properly. Do you see what I mean? You know, couldn't label fucking dats of like recorded shows properly and things like that. And there were all sorts of little problems that, you know what I mean? If you deliver the master, like saying this is the show and it's not labeled correctly, you know, you say here are the five shows for the week and they're not labeled correctly, do you know what I mean? That's a problem. Do you know what I mean? It's little things like that, you know. So ultimately, it's quite difficult because you're trying to run a business and there's money involved in that business, and then you know there's work. Everybody's trying to do different work and everything, and you've got different ideas of what everybody's work is worth. And one of the things that we hadn't necessarily built in to the contract and the way that we priced it out, because we were naive and we were new to it and everything, was okay, well actually we hadn't priced ourselves in very well. Do you see what I mean? So it's like, okay, like, you know, we'd kind of done the BBC this wonderful deal where we would essentially, we'd hire in producers and people and get everything up and running, because you couldn't do all the work yourself. But like, we hadn't actually priced ourselves into the business, so that so ultimately it wasn't sustainable.
But if you hadn't done that before, you're right, you wouldn't know. But it's almost like a master's in business going through that period where you suddenly clock. It's, again, hindsight is a wonderful thing, right? But you find yourself on Six Music, started at the same time as One Extra, around about the same time.
Yeah, started about the same, One Extra, and I went there sort of 2007. And did 2007 till 2009,
and that was again early Weekend Breakfast, was it?
Yeah, so yeah, that was Weekend Breakfast. I did, so I went in to originally to do a show called Six Mix, and then did Weekend Breakfast, and then the kind of management of the station changed, and the new people came in and was like, oh, what's he doing here? We don't quite get it. And so they didn't renew my contract, and that was the end of that.
How did you find that period? Because obviously, it was quite an intense 2 years with Jason.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly behind the mic, you leave that behind, you're back in front of the mic again.
Yeah,
quite a different environment, I can imagine, working at Six Music.
Well, totally. And originally I'd said to Jay, do you want to come and do this? And he wasn't interested, because it was like, so because the music, I did a popular music studies degree, so like I didn't, you know, whilst I've, you know, I was interested in and focused on and really sort of committed to black music, that wasn't all the music that was, do you know what I mean, from in my head. So like, it's like, oh yeah, no, do you know what I mean, you talk about some rock music, let's talk about some rock music, let's do that, do you know what I mean? I could, you know, because like I didn't, you know, I came from it from more of a musicological thing as opposed to like the DJ, club DJ type mentality, do you know what I mean, where you have your genre of music that you play. It's like, no, I was just into music, so it didn't really matter to me. It's like, okay, right, we're doing black music today, great, all right, and now we're doing rock music, and we're talking about indie bands, and so it didn't matter to me, do you know what I mean? It was all just music, and I kind of understood it on that level.
But you were by yourself in the studio, that must have been a bit of a shift.
Yeah, so that was difficult, but also, just, I mean, the thing is that, like, you know, whilst that was a bit of a shift, it was like, it was a shift that I was kind of ready for, because, you know, like, Jay's a good guy, but he's very like, okay, right, I'm in charge, do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, we had the I remember us having the conversation about whether the show was going to be called Yare and Jason or Jason and Yare, do you know what I mean? And it was like, no, it was definitely Jason and Yare, and he absolutely insisted on that, and that's all. He was that guy, do you know what I mean? And that's not a bad thing, it's not a criticism, it's just that's what it was. So I get it, I can be a sort of the second fiddle type of a guy, but it's not my natural thing, so I was ready to kind of not be that dude anymore. So it wasn't a big deal from my point of view in terms of that shift, because I was ready to, you know, I always needed a few bits and pieces that I was doing so that I could kind of offset that feeling, do you see what I mean, and feel like, oh, I had a bit of agency and I was driving things myself, because, you know, Jason was always very, very dominant in that situation.
During that period, what were your thoughts in terms of the wider career? Did you have something in mind, or were you kind of having to reset exactly what you were going
so
to do?
So once the Six Music thing came to an end, then I really had to start thinking hard, because this point now, so this is 2009. So 2009 is the year I got married. I had my first kid that year as well. Without that sort of regular income from presenting shows coming in, I had to like really. So by 2010, I'm back working retail. Do you know what I mean? After that, you know, because I'm part time, because I needed to kind of even things out, you know, in terms of that sort of wild swinging around of sometimes you had some money, sometimes you didn't. I had to even that out and make sure that I could make a mortgage payment each month. So I took a bit of retail job. I did bits and pieces. And I tried to keep the media thing going. I think one of the things that was really, really disheartening during that whole period, or like was really difficult for me to deal with, like, which I should have, you know, again, benefit of hindsight. But I remember I used to go and do a show at Radio 5 Live called Fighting Talk.
Yeah.
Colin Murray used to present it, right? And so I'd go along and I'd be on this show and it'd be great. And I'd started doing it, like, because I'd gone along to a radio, one of these briefings, and I'd met one of the producers of the show and we'd gotten chatting and he'd kind of invited me to come along and try and do it. And it was great. And that's, I was still at One Extra when that had happened. So it was this little extra thing that occasionally I would do and I'd get doing it. But I remember one time going over, so they used to do it like from TVC.
Yeah,
West London, like White City that way. And I remember going over and doing Fighting Talk and like broadcasting to a million people. And you know, like there'd be like people like Sean Locke and Bob Mills and people like that on these shows. And go and you do these shows and be brilliant. And I remember one day finishing that show and whoever I was on with, you know, one person was going off to their book signing and another one was going off to, you know, to a gig, another, the latest gig on their comedy tour, and another one was going off, I think Rick Edwards was going off to kind of present a TV show. And I went into the toilet, put on my Apple t-shirt and went across the road to the White City, you know, to the Westfield, went and did an 8-hour shift on the shop floor at the Apple store. And I really was like, oh man, I just didn't feel like I should be in this situation. Do you know what I mean?
Really?
You know,
so that could have gone one of two ways. That could be you saying I shouldn't be working at Apple, I should be actually you had an imposter syndrome, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. I had a crisis of confidence
despite doing Breakfast on One Extra,
sort of stuff. Do you see what I mean? I was like, you know, I didn't have a regular radio gig and everything, and I was coming along to do Radio 5 Live Fighting Talk and I wasn't in it, I wasn't involved in it. Do you know what I mean? So I just felt like I shouldn't do that, you know, and so I kind of pulled back from that and started to kind of work out, okay, well, what should I be doing? And so the first process of that was focusing on, it was that 80-20 principle. Okay, what is the 20% of what I'm doing that's giving me 80% of my freelance income? What are the things that are the most lucrative? And so there were two things that I started to focus on. So I got myself to a situation where I was maybe doing 20 hours a week at the Apple store, and what I'd done is that we'd moved house, we'd downsized and everything, so rather than having it wasn't like that swanky, but we had an apartment in a serviced building in Peckham, right, and it was like a converted school, do you see what I mean? And there were two things wrong with it. One, it was really expensive for what it was, and two, like, we had a baby and that baby was turning into a toddler, and you realise this whole place is set up for adults. It's not set up for toddlers. And it just felt like everything in the entire environment was like hazardous to her health. And was like, we have got to move, right? So we managed to find a place. We sold our flat, you know, for less money than what we sold our flat for. We bought a house. It's a little bit further out of town, out in Lewisham. You know, but it was a little 3-bedroom house. And it meant that the baby had her own bedroom and we had a bedroom and we had another room. And then I set up a little studio and then I was working from there for a while and everything. You know, so we did that. And then the overhead, we got our overheads right down, like London service charges and all that sort of stuff. And we had to pay for a parking space. Do you see what I mean? Whereas this house had a free parking space right outside the front door. Do you know what I mean? So, like, you know, all those sorts of things. Get your overhead right down. And then we started to kind of work out what is this. So let's start focusing on two clients that I had as a freelancer where I was getting most of the money from. And one was Black Entertainment Television, whom I used to make radio adverts. And the other was BFI, which was the British Film Institute, where I used to go in and either host events for young people or like host kind of workshop-y type things, all for the young people. So essentially, so I just focused on those two things. So I made loads and loads of radio adverts on my little Pro Tools rig left over from when we were running the production company. Mm-hmm. And you know, so I did that there, and then I would do I'd go and host these gigs and things at the British Film Institute, and I just focused on those two people and said, like, what can I do, how can I be helpful and everything. I remember one of the things I worked out was that I was at the Apple store and they released the iPad. Mm-hmm. and then they did an update to the iPad, and there was a dongle that allowed you to really easily connect it to other things like HDMI or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I went into the BFI, and I was like, hey, look at this, right? You've got, you know, here is, you know, we've got iMovie on the iPad. So now here is a device where you can shoot and edit a little bit of film. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, you're trying to show young kids how film works and how the mechanics of film works and how storytelling via film works. Here you go. Here's one device you can put in their hands and they can do the whole process. They can film themselves a little bit and then they can edit it. And then, you know, they've gone through the process of thinking like mm-hmm. a filmmaker. And they were really impressed. I did this kind of presentation with it and I showed how you could use a device. And they were like, cool. Do you know what I mean? And so that's how I got into the... Eventually, what happened was I started going in there more and more often doing like little bits of freelancing. And then eventually they offered me a contract to come in one day a week, and so I would do that alongside the Apple store, and then that turned into like 3 days a week, and so I'd kind of cut back my Apple store hours and everything a little bit. So I think at which point I cut them down to maybe like 16 hours a week or whatever. So I'd go in there 2 days a week, and I'd go to BFI 3 days a week, and then eventually they offered me a 5 day a week contract, and then eventually that turned into a permanent position and everything. And I was in the education department at the BFI programming what they call the Future Film Program, which was like, you know, program for 16 to 25 year olds, and like events, and there'd be a monthly event and everything, and I was doing all of that, and I'd program and curate those events. And then one day, so a couple of things happened during that period. So one was I started to realize that there might be an opportunity to kind of, with the BFI, they had a venue and all that sort of stuff. So we started putting on these events where we'd invite filmmakers, black filmmakers, because they didn't have any opportunity. No, they didn't have any opportunities. They didn't have necessarily a variety of opportunities. So we just give people an opportunity to show their film in a prestigious venue and everything, and you know, hopefully be able to leverage that to do other things. You know, at the very least, when you go and have your next meeting, and what have you been up to? I'll just show the film of mine at the BFI. Sounded good, right? So we started doing that, and that eventually kind of spiraled and started to become its own thing. And that, so that was one thing that happened. And then the other thing that happened, because I did that, I invited the BFI's new head of D&I down to one of the events, and she was like, oh, you know, she was quite impressed in that, and eventually kind of invited me to apply for a job in her department, which is how I then made that cross into the D&I situation.
I might be connecting dots that don't need connecting, but I'm sensing throughout your career, even before you joined the BBC, you have this theme of wanting to help people, give people a leg up. Is that a conscious thing? Do you think is that true?
I don't know. I think it's, you know, I don't know. I just think it's just something, you know. I think certainly it's certain, like, you know, it's certainly something I became more conscious of later. I'm aware that when I kind of go, okay, right, I'm trying to help people, things just pop off. Things just start to work. They connect. Things happen. You know what I mean? You know, so I know that, like, trying to find ways to be of service works for me. But good things kind of come out of that, right? But we'd always hear stories about, like, you know, you'd meet a random person when I was a kid, you know what I mean? And they'd be, oh, your mum helped me so much with this or whatever. Or... like, I remember really, like, just meeting loads of people who I didn't know at my dad's funeral, and tell me all these stories about how he'd helped them with this and he'd given them that and everything, you know. And I was thinking, who's that dude? I feel like, you know what I mean? I was constantly chasing around this dude to give me something, do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, and I met all these people who were like, for whom he was this kind of amazing, like, giving person. So I think it's like I'm kind of wired like that anyway, do you know what I mean? But like, but I kind of found out later that, like, that's how I make things work for me, that I find ways in which I can take my experience, my knowledge, my network, my connections, and use it to help other people, and that works for me. And then other, you know, then, you know, I kind of, things come back to me that kind of make it worthwhile. But I can't do it in a sort of a conscious way. I just look back and go, oh yeah, no, because I did that, this thing, that door opened, or this thing happened and everything. But and you can't ever do it like, if I do this, I'll get it. I can't, that doesn't work for me. But I've just find that if I put enough stuff out there, then things come back.
That's nice. That's really good. In 2014, you co-founded Soul, S-O-U-L. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so basically I'm at the BFI and a couple of things are happening. So one, people will come to me, oh, you're at the BFI, how do I get my film at the BFI? I don't know, bruv, do you know what I mean? And then I also realised that, I would go in and I'd work amongst a bunch, eventually it turned into a job, but I would go in amongst this team of kind of freelance people, yeah, filmmakers and different people. And I noticed occasionally, people like, this guy who's gone on to doing very well for himself, like Rob Savage, for instance, right, he's a film director now. And he would come in and say, I've just made this short film. Can I use the auditorium to show it to like the crew and friends and family? And they'd be like, yeah, cool, we can do that. And they'd find a little bit of time in, downtime in the schedule. Often the public program would happen from sort of 5 or 6 in the evening. So, if you came in at like 3 in the afternoon, you could show something and get your people in and out before, and it wouldn't necessarily, they could kind of arrange things like that. And so we were like, oh, bloody hell, why are we doing that? So those two things, like, hold on, we know all these people here and we could make the ask, could we use the auditorium? And two, this idea of people kind of wanting to, how do I get my film on at the BFI? And we put those two things together and realised that we could open up this space for people to come into the BFI. So we started that. Then as we started to put together the first of those events, we realized that one event wasn't going to be enough, so we thought we'd better come up with a brand for it and everything. So the idea of screening our unseen lives, that's where that came from, where we needed something to call it. And then the guys at the BFI education department, love them, they kind of thought, this is good, you should do this more often. And so we did it every 3 months for about 4 years, 5 years, something like that. And then during that period, we tried to talk the people who run the public program into allowing us to do a thing in the public program. So that these were like essentially a private event. And we was like, we think we could create and like events that people would actually buy tickets for, and pay to come and see. And so eventually, after a few years of trying to convince them, they eventually went and allowed us to do it. And there was a key woman who was instrumental in kind of making that happen. There's two people over there who were really instrumental in making it happen. Multiple people, really. But like, I remember like there was a woman called Michelle White early on, and then a guy who's still there running things called Stuart Brown, and there was an amazing woman called Gaylin Gould. And between them, at different stages, they were the people that ultimately helped that festival to start happening. And that's still running to this day. To this very day.
Are you involved in it at all?
I am. Yeah. I'm the director of the festival, and I'm working on it every day between, my BBC job and everything. I do little bits and pieces on it pretty much every day of the year.
Great. And so obviously comes full circle. You come back into the bosom of the BBC.
Yeah.
In general terms, what was that feeling like coming back into the BBC?
But it was weird.
That time in your life.
It was it was weird because it would have been much more of a sort of a victory, end zone touchdown dance. baby, I'm back. But it was COVID. Do you know what I mean? So I was at home with a laptop. Do you know what I mean? Like just going to endless Zoom meetings. Do you know what I mean? So it's like it wasn't the sort of big triumphant return. Do you know what I mean? Guess who's back, baby? Come on, you know what I mean? All that. It wasn't that. So, but what it was interesting because, and this is what I mean in terms of, because we set up the soul thing because we thought we could help people out, but from the outside, it was like, oh, you found a solution. You found a D&I solution. You've kind of created, so that's how I kind of crossed over into the sort of D&I work. That's what opened that up. From there, then that's how I kind of, and then I just pitched and just talked to people. I came along, did a job interview and talked to them about, okay, this is what you did, this is what I would do, this is how this would work, this is why you do it, and convinced people that I had something worthwhile to contribute. Do you see what I mean? And that, but the only reason I knew how to do anything, because because literally I talked to loads and loads of filmmakers about the issues and the problems and their point of view, so I was able to kind of present that back. But it's only because I tried to help people that so I don't have D&I training, I don't have D&I qualifications, I just have experience of helping people who are finding it difficult to access the film and TV industry from different sorts of backgrounds, and I was able to use that sort of insight and information to kind of turn that into a job, really.
That's awesome, because I think a lot of people listening, they would look at your career, an amazing career, breakfast presenter, running a production company, working at the BFI, coming up with all these different vehicles to allow people into different opportunities. Were there any moments where it was kind of pinch yourself, or was it all kind of in reflection, you look back and kind of go, oh, that was kind of neat.
There are loads of moments. There are loads of moments. I remember one time when we were on extra, we were in a hotel and we were on one of these junkets, and we were basically, these press junkets, I can't remember what the movie was, but we got to interview Samuel L. Jackson or whatever, and we decided, right, what we'll do is we'll put a load of different examples of like kind of the music that One Extra was on a CD and play into it and see what he thought. Do you know what I mean? What do you think of this? And do you know what I mean? And I just remembered having this moment where he kind of stopped the guy, because they were, you know, did these 5 minute interviews, and he stopped the person and said, no, I want to keep the, do you know what I mean?
Because
he likes music and he likes culture, and he was into it, and he just wanted to keep it going for a few more minutes. And so I remember that being like a bit of a moment. I remember interviewing Alicia Keys at Radio 2 for our, like, Jason and I did a little kind of Radio 2 little experimental series. We left One Extra, and we went in there and said, you know, the hip-hop generation is aging into your demographic. You should have a black music show. They were like, oh, that's an interesting idea. And as part of that show, we interviewed Alicia Keys, and I remember the producer saying, you did that whole interview like this with your mouth hanging out, and I was like, do you know what I mean? I was just like... so there was loads of money. I mean, like, even like last summer when we did like we did the film festival, and we had this incredible moment where Letitia Wright and Tamara Lawrence, they come and presented this film called the Silent Twins, and it was just this real moment. And like that whole festival, like that, you know, that whole 3 days was really like kind of incredible as well. Do you know what I mean? You think, bloody hell, you know, this was just an idea and now it's an actual thing that actually happens every year, you know. So yeah, you get those sort of moments and everything. But equally, you know, as great as all of that is, I have a, like, you know, on my phone I have a video of when I taught my daughter how to ride her bike, and I promise you that feels like one of the, like, literally, definitely, like, teaching my kids how to ride a bike, both of them, like, you know what I mean, it's like, feels like up there amongst my greatest achievements. Or like, or, you know, earlier this year when my brother came from New York and surprised me for my birthday, do you know what I mean? I walked down the stairs into the front room and he was standing there. I was like, what? You know what I mean? So I have, like, you know, career and everything is brilliant and I love all that, but like, amongst all of that, like, there are moments from my personal life, do you know what I mean, that feel as big or as significant, do you see what I mean? And so I don't put it in those sorts of terms, so I'm not necessarily maybe as career focused as you'd think I was, do you see what I mean? It's much more about, yeah, it's definitely about balance.
Yare Igihon and how he became something in media. How did Yare carve out such an amazing career? We'll get further insight from our in-house careers advisor via our website at somethingin.media, where you can glean a deeper understanding of what it takes to make it in the media and even the opportunity to book a one-on-one session. You'll also find a newsletter, sign up via our website. Something In Media is a Stable production. And if you enjoyed it, don't miss an episode by pressing the subscribe button or follow button wherever you get your podcasts. And if you think someone may benefit by listening to these types of stories, please do let them know where to find us.